Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore. I'll be your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Got a great lineup of guests coming in right now. Very shortly here, we'll be talking with Dr. Kathy DiLorenzo and Dr. Jim Powell. They're the faculty of the Master of Public Affairs program out at the University of Alaska School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast. The Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center starting up their Friday Fireside Lectures. John Neary will be here to tell about his trip across Admiralty Island when he toted and paddled his way across the island back in the early 90s. Juneau Cabaret is coming up. Laura Haywood will be here to talk about that. It's Sunday at 7 at Rockwell. Treadwell Arena is hosting events, and Lauren Anderson will be telling us about their schedule. And the 2015 Innovation Summit is coming up. Stay tuned. Time now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today we wrap up our series on climate change and Alaska Native people. As Alaskans grapple with the effects of a warming planet, agencies are not often able to provide all the help needed to address issues associated with climate change. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
In Alaska, climate change effects include rivers that suddenly melt, unleashing floods that erode riverbanks, and permafrost that melts, damaging foundations and causing structures to sink into the ground. Bruce Exauer is chief of the Civil Works Program in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Alaska office.
On our 2009 report, the baseline erosion assessment, we identified about 26 communities which were kind of out there on the edge and we're about ready to experience one of the types of losses that you're talking about, either a runway, a water system, a school, a power plant, something that would be a critical shutdown for the community.
In the past, in northwest Alaska, the sea froze from the shore out and protected coastal villages from the force of fall storms. Now the ice develops later in the year, and the village of Shaktulik is getting battered. Eugene Asiksik, Shaktulik's former mayor and current vice mayor, says the community has been working unsuccessfully for years to relocate. Then, a 2013 storm hurled drift logs to within a few feet of homes, and he says the community put up its own defenses.
Now we have a berm about a mile and a half long in front of the village, and a gravel berm is about 8 to 10 feet high in places and 10 to 12 feet wide.
The hope is that the berm will absorb the force of surging seas and crashing waves and buy time for the village while it figures out its next steps. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Wisconsin's six Chippewa tribes are wrapping up a conference on economic alternatives to mining, held this week on the Red Cliff Reservation. As WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports, the tribes are opposing plans for an iron ore mine in the Pinoki Range.
The Red Cliff Tribe's mining resources specialist, Sandy Goki, says the Chippewa Federation is inviting specialists to talk about the impacts of iron mining as well as explore the potential of other economic drivers.
And we wanted them to share their knowledge about the effects of mining, viable alternatives to extraction, and cultural knowledge, because we wanted to kind of bring it all together with our native worldview.
Goki hopes the discussion will result in concrete plans for economic development.
Actual strategic planning to get the ball rolling on these different ideas, whatever fits your specific community best. So some places don't really have the soil to grow food very well. Maybe you're in a good place for solar. You know, who knows?
Presentation topics include food sovereignty, sustainable forestry, recycling and solid waste, and maple syrup production. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski in Rhinelander, Wisconsin.
Funeral services were held this week in New Mexico for Okeawinge artist Geronima Montoya. The 99-year-old had spent the last few weeks in different hospitals recovering from surgery after a recent fall. She was well known for her award-winning paintings and led the art program at the Santa Fe Indian School for more than 20 years. Her recognitions include the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts. Her son, Robert Montoya, says she was surrounded by family and friends when she died last week at an Albuquerque hospital. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thank you. National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support National Native News. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA FM Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are a couple of welcome doctors. the faculty out at the University of Alaska Southeast sports a number of outstanding academicians, and two of them are very involved in a unique program. I think it may be the only one in the state. It's certainly the only online program in the state that gives someone the ability to earn the Master of Public Affairs.
Administration.
Public administration. So let's start by making a distinction between a master's in business administration, which some of us hold, and a master's in public administration. What's the difference? Oh, my guests, by the way, are Dr. Kathy DiLorenzo, who's the director of the program, and assistant professor of public administration, Dr. Jim Powell. Welcome.
Thank you, Pat. I'll take that first question. The real difference between the Master of Business Administration and Master of Public Administration is the focus on the public versus the private sector. And so we train managers with knowledge and skills to operate in local, state, tribal, federal, and governments, as well as nonprofits, and the relation between that. It's a strategic perspective of a general management master's degree that can overlay on almost any degree that would be appropriate in a government or nonprofit sector. And as we know, many of us that work in those sectors know that almost every degree is represented within those sectors, from engineers to counselors to educators to policymakers and everything. And so we provide a general management degree that people can overlay on their expertise and give them some skill and knowledge to rise to that more middle-level, upper-level management positions.
So I'm reaching back into the dim mists of antiquity here, remembering that the MBA program had courses in things like economics, mm-hmm. marketing, management, general business stuff, personnel, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So what are the differences in the curriculum?
So we overlay. We're both basically organizational development degrees and organizational leadership degrees. And so we share curriculum in things like human resource management and organizational structure and behavior issues, as well as economics and finance, just a different perspective of that economics, different bottom line perspectives of economics and finance. We have courses in program evaluation, administrative law, which differs from business law, of course, and also let's see what else we have. I got to go through my list of things. So, yeah, economics, finance, research methods, program evaluation. And then we also have specialty areas that mimic governmental areas or public sector areas, such as what Jim here has been teaches for us, which is natural resource management. We have an option for a concentration in rural development. Talking about how small rural communities develop their organizational structures given their resources and their unique experiences.
So, Jim, natural resources management, do you have other areas that you also teach in?
Yeah, maybe a couple of words. First, thanks for inviting us in. This is great. the natural resource policy track or concentration started a few years ago. It's really, we live in a great place to talk about natural resources, and natural resource policy is a big issue in this state, always will be. So we started that concentration, and just to give you an idea of what that's about, some of the courses are natural resource policy, a broad class, and then adaptive management, ecological economics, that kind of stuff. And then another course that we started, and people are always wondering what that's all about, and that's local and global sustainability. I got my PhD in natural resources and sustainability science from UAF, and I teach sustainability. In fact, our program is the only program at UAS that teaches sustainability as far as a class in it. And we thread that those concepts, and we make it real. It's applied sustainability in public administration and also in local governance. So those are the kind of classes we teach. In fact, this spring, we're teaching a class in adaptive management, and we're teaching a new class. I'm teaching a new class in local government, which really is an applied class for people that think they're already in local government or interested in local government, or they want to be a city manager or a city clerk. And so we're teaching a class in that for the first time, and we've actually got a really good response. We're almost full. And that starts this semester. So those are the kind of things. We're trying to be responsive to the needs of the community. And right now you have a lot of natural resource agencies in the state. I mean, that's what we do here. Forestry, mining, oil and gas, those kind of things. So let's get smarter about those things. Let's take the theory. Let's look at the case studies and come out a little smarter.
And the prerequisite for any master's degree, of course, is having a bachelor's degree. So I guess the question is, what bachelor's degrees are you finding are most successful in your program?
Well, I think that's one of the really great things about our program, and one of the reasons why I have an MPA as well, is that it's an incredibly versatile degree. Like I say, it's more of a general management, applying general management principles to the various sectors of of the public sector. And so I wouldn't say that there are those that excel coming in with a certain bachelor's degree, because we really bring people in, acclimate them through an introduction class, which is PADM 601. We like everybody to start with that class. Gives them an introduction to the theory and how we apply that theory and the practice of applying that theory to public sector issues. And what we are is Alaskan-focused, Alaskan and Yukon-focused. So all of our students come from Alaska and the Yukon Territory. So we take the places that they work now. The majority of our students, over 95%, I would say, are working full-time professionals in the public sector in some capacity in Alaska or the Yukon Territory. So what we do is we take their backgrounds and where they're working, and they apply that directly in the classes through their assignments to then understand the general management and leadership, organizational, financial, economic evaluation principles that are appropriate and that go across for all managers.
There are different processes in public administration as opposed to private sector, and that's what we teach. For example, there's the Sunshine Law. I mean, open processes. What is that all about? A person in the private sector may never have heard that, but now works in the public sector and goes, hey, I got to go through this public process. So we teach those things. There are certain processes that they will learn about, as well as legal requirements. There's administrative law. There's a lot of stuff there. Human resources, disclosure, Meetings Act. A lot of different things to it. So when you come out, you're ready to know what public administration, the public sector is about, and the different components of it. In every agency, you have fiscal stuff going on, you've got human resources stuff going on, you have your content areas, like in natural resources. We talk about the different natural resources and ecological systems. But there are systems that will really help you do your job when you get out.
People don't, maybe people do understand that one of the things that goes on in any academic organization is you have a public service component, mm-hmm. you have a research component, mm-hmm. and this is essentially as much about holding the professors and the faculty members to a standard and helping them further themselves. So talk a little bit about the aspects of that. I understand, for instance, you're about to engage in some research with the Institute of Social and Economic Research out of the University of Alaska in Anchorage.
Yeah, and I'll let Jim talk a little bit about that component of it. Actually, we're ready to host a couple of people out of ICER and another organization. I'll let Jim touch on that. What I'm also involved in, you're right, that we do have a service component to our work. And one of the great things about being a public administration faculty in an applied program where students are applying the things that they're learning every week in their jobs. And one of my most favorite things that they say is, what I learn on Thursday, I can apply at work on Friday. And so we feel that we are satisfying a lot of that service research component through the applied research that we help our students to do in their own organizations to learn their concepts. One of the great opportunities that we have right now is the survey that is being conducted through the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's office about public input concerning the fiscal crisis here in Alaska, crisis, if I may call it that, in Alaska, and it's a very difficult time for us in terms of that. And this Governor and Lieutenant Governor are very sincere about wanting to get public input on that. And so they've got two surveys out, one to the citizens of Alaska, which many people have seen, and one privately to state employees to get their personal thoughts on that as well. And we've been asked to help in that process to analyze the qualitative responses that come back in. When I say qualitative, the word responses that come back in, the narratives that people spin about what they feel the state can do or what the state's priorities should be. And so we're going to have some students that are going to be able to analyze that information for the state and give that information back to the officials of the state to be able to incorporate that information in their decision making. We're very excited about that.
Yeah, real honor for the program. Jim, yes, almost out of time, so can you tell us about the upcoming ISER presentation?
On Thursday, January 21st, Gunnar Knapp and Cliff Groh will be here in town. They'll be talking about, and the goal of their presentation really is to really give a, not to advocate a position, but to talk about the fiscal challenge that's in front of us. So that's Wednesday, 7 o'clock, out at UAS at the Egan Lecture Hall, and they're going to talk about the fiscal situation. Gunnar Knapp is the head of ICER from UAA. These guys are real experts, and a guy named Cliff Groh, who's been around the state for a long time, who's the head of Common Ground from Anchorage. They'll be here out at the university Wednesday night, 7 o'clock. Come out, listen to them, ask good questions, and let's get informed about this very important, very important.
Outstanding.
Topic.
Dr. Jim Powell, Dr. Kathy Lorenzo, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on the NPA program at UAS.
Thanks, Pat.
You know, 19 minutes after the hour. This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My next guests are two gentlemen who served the public in many different and interesting ways. John Neary is, the director of the Mendenhall Glacier National Monument, right?
Visitor Center.
Yeah. Visitor Center. Okay, and Chad Van Orme, you're the monument director for which component?
Cool. For the Admiralty National Monument.
Okay. And so these little chunks of land around here that are all parts of the national forest and like that have mm-hmm. so many different designations that it's kind of hard to keep track. Practically every time I have someone from your organization in here, I have to question myself whether I know that chunk of land has a designation mm-hmm. or not.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty cool designation that Admiralty has, you know, that national monument, because Jimmy Carter set it aside so far back, you know, back in 78. And since then, it's also wilderness, you know, yet another title, meaning it has specific meanings to both the Forest Service and to people in mm-hmm. general.
Both you work for the National Forest Service?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And the reason we're talking to these folks is really exciting as well, because the wonderful series that comes along every year out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center, where on Friday nights we give the same presentation for the early crowd at 6:30.
Correct.
And then we repeat the presentation at 8 o'clock. These occur out in that beautiful center out there, which opens up just for this purpose on Friday nights. And their topics are just amazing topics. They run over such a broad range. And the very first one is going to be probably some really exciting stuff from you, John, about having crossed Admiralty Island on first canoe and then pack raft. And I guess, I don't know, have you ever tried to run across?
No, but I know somebody who did.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I'll be talking about him.
Okay.
Are you going to come tonight, Dan Legler?
And so this is a chance for us to find out something about what a wilderness ranger actually is about.
Yeah, it's a bit about that. Uh-huh. You know, because that's my roots on Admiralty Island, really, was starting as a wilderness ranger in 83, and my whole job was paddling a canoe, a Grumman canoe, I should add. I should add the weight to 72 pounds, back and forth across the island all summer. I think the first summer I did 10 trips, and then the next summer another 6 trips. That was really, you know, cutting my teeth as a ranger. And also, I was only 24 years old, right? So it didn't matter that it was 72 pounds. Now I'm 55, and it matters. And that's part of what I'm going to talk about tonight.
So you've gone to a lighter venue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I notice ultralight and guys who still do it in the woods sort of go together. You know?
Yeah.
It's like we really like paring the ounces off.
It's a lot easier on the knees, yeah.
Yeah, I'm starting to understand why people saw the handles off their toothbrushes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so tell me about what the job of a monument ranger is, as opposed to the wilderness ranger that was just described to us.
Yeah, so my job as a monument ranger is really to oversee all the operations and stewardship activities that happen on the National Monument. And a big part of that is kind of connecting people to the resources out there, whether it's, you know, going out to have a recreation and wilderness experience, or we do have a lot of people that are just generally interested in the community to come out and volunteer and do stewardship activities as well. So, you know, John's presentation tonight is a great kind of story about the National Monument and the Cross Admiralty Canoe Route that was constructed, you know, by the Forest Service in combination with the Civilian Conservation Corps back in the 1930s. Of course, it does have a history even before that, and I think John is going to present that story too tonight at the Fireside Lecture. But today, you know, the route still has a lot of value to the community to get that kind of wilderness recreation experience, to kind of escape, and has this great series of lakes and cabins and trails that that really allow people to get out there and experience the best that Admiralty has.
Some of the best solitude you can find around Juneau, really.
John, I guess I'm curious. Now, Admiralty has a fairly high population of bears, does it not?
Fairly.
Yeah. Like, for instance, more than people.
Sorry, asking you if I'm going to show bear photos tonight?
Well, no, what I'm asking is, how much of that do you, how do you handle the awareness of that when you're on a wilderness experience on Admiralty Island
in
a canoe alone?
It's so natural to be aware of bears when you're on Admiralty Island, I have to say. They come in at night when you're sleeping, because they come into your dreams, they come into everything. But I have to say, though, that a lot of people overreact to the whole bear thing, really. A can of pepper spray was enough for us. That was just fine. We did great. We always will, you know. And
did you have to use it?
No.
No.
We did see a couple bears. They were at some distance, very safe, beautiful, watching them grazing in the sedges up on the beaches. Down in Mole Harbor, when we got to the other end of the trip, I went to get water from the creek. And when I got back, my daughter said, oh, yeah, you just missed a couple of bears. I said, what? She said, yeah, yeah, it was a big one and a small one, and they went running by us on the trail. And I went, what? But it was just fine. They probably caught our scent, you know, some minutes after we arrived and beat feet out of there and were gone by the time we walked out onto the estuary.
The truth that I know about bears is that they're far more frightened of us than we are of them under most of circumstances.
Exactly.
Yeah. So far, the bears have not organized and gotten guns and pepper spray, so it's...
That's a big equalizer, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. So, yeah, and how about as Monument Ranger, do you have to deal with overexcited tourists or people who go on wilderness adventures and decide they're going to get eaten?
Well, we do have a great facility out there, the Pack Creek Bear Viewing Area as well, and that place is kind of the place where tourists will go to try and get that experience to view one of the Kutznuwu bears that are out there. You know, that place is pretty heavily regulated. We have staff out there. We operate it in conjunction with the Department of Fish and Game. So it is a great kind of introductory kind of learning experience for people who aren't so comfortable just kind of stepping foot in the wild where there are bears. But it is a great place to kind of learn about their behaviors, their habitat, and way to kind of just be safe in bear country. Just have to say also that that John, you know, he's had 30 years on Admiralty, and you know, I too, when I first arrived, had my apprehension about being in bear country and stepping foot on Admiralty. But learning from John and just the bear behaviors, stories, and that he shares was really helpful. And now I kind of understand that they're not hiding behind every tree and they're not out there to get you necessarily. So
not necessarily.
But yeah, it's fantastic.
Let's hold the spirit of adventure at least. I hear it in the back of your voice there, John.
Well, it is, isn't it? It's part of the charm of our wilderness in Alaska. We are so lucky on this Tongass National Forest to have every predator that has ever existed. I mean, how many states in America can say that? Very few.
No.
Every predator that's the top of the food chain, they're mostly eliminated because of their threats to people or farmers or ranchers, right? So we're very lucky to have them, and I feel that sense of privilege when we go to these places. And I also feel a sense of responsibility to do the right thing, you know, hang our food up at night and keep it away from the bears so they don't come into my camp. That's good for both of us. You know, as an example, make a little noise when I'm coming out of the brush and out into an open estuary where I might expect to see them, give them a little fair warning. Those are great tips.
You did the follow-up trips using pack rats.
Yeah, see, that's the key of this presentation tonight.
Yeah.
And it's really the focus of it in the sense that I feel that pack rats is a game changer for this route because I really enjoyed it at 24 years old, packing that canoe. That was a great job, right? But I wouldn't have considered doing it again this summer because it was a lot of work. You have to carry your canoe across and then come back and get the rest of your gear and then carry it all the way across. So you're crossing every portage three times. And when you realize that the portage, for example, between the waters by Angoon called Mitchell Bay and the first lake, Davidson, that's over 3 miles to get that one direction. So then you got to go back 3 miles, and then you got to come back 3 miles again. Mm-hmm. You've done 9 miles. Whereas this one, with the pack raft, you put the pack raft on your pack, and you just walk across. And you're looking at the forest. You're not underneath that turtle shell of a canoe, wondering what's lurking ahead of you on the trail. It's really a different experience altogether.
So can you more closely describe for me what a pack raft is?
Yes.
I don't think I've ever actually seen one,
except
in pictures.
There was a great photo on the Empire story today about it. But it's tiny. It's lightweight. And it's very easy to deal with. It's easy to learn. It's easy to use. So my pack raft was by Alpaca Raft Company, and they're sold from these women in Colorado that make them or from a retailer in Anchorage. They weigh only about 6 pounds, and they roll up to the size of a bedroll, like a classic old cowboy bedroll size, and then you put them right on the top of your pack. You have a set of paddles. That's all. That's all there is.
So you have it's a kayak-type paddle that you just hook together?
In fact, I use my kayak paddle.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, and then all of the rest of your gear, I noticed, I saw the photograph on the front page of the outdoor section today as well. All of your gear, your pack, was sitting in the front of it.
Yes.
Is that, like, lashed in there somehow?
It is.
Yeah, okay.
As a matter of fact, so you take your backpack off, and then you put it on the bow of this little boat, and you've got a skirt around your waist to keep the water off keep it out of the boat.
So like a kayak.
Somewhat like that,
okay.
Yes. And then the pack goes on top of that skirt up on the bow. You lash it tight, And that gives you also a counterbalance in the boat, because your weight in the back of this tiny little thing would make it very rear heavy, but your pack makes it also a little front heavy, so it helps you find that balance, puts the boat a little lower in the water to help you resist the wind a bit. And it's a great combination, really, because the only thing you need to think about in the rainforest really is how do you keep your gear dry when it's dumping rain. You got to get that pack inside a trash bag or have some sort of waterproof pack, which is what I took.
Does it have a bottom at all?
It does, yes, very much. It's got a nylon, very thin nylon bottom.
Okay, but there's no boards or anything like that?
No, nothing like that.
Okay,
that would be far too much weight.
Yeah, okay. So, the interesting technology. When did people start using pack rats?
You know, I don't know the first one, but I know when it appeared in my radar, which was when Aaron and Hig did their trip up the coast. You remember those folks that did that wonderful long walk? Yeah, and
Greg
Cheney did the film about them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first I really realized what these were about. But I have to say that my neighbor Mike Miller has been using them for many years on his adventures, paddling them all over and using them to connect his major hikes that he's done, like all the way down from Haines and up to, you know, across to Angoon and other places. He's really traveled some miles in that little raft.
It sounds like this is a vehicle that opens up whole new areas and vistas for
us
here in Alaska.
And another different one, which I also realized when I was in Denali, is you can hike up a valley in Denali, get up to the headwaters, inflate your pack raft, and then float the river out.
Ah.
Isn't that wonderful? So you get that wonderful different types of experience.
Yeah.
It also saves you from having to beat the brush all the way back the same way you came.
Yeah.
It opens up a different way to experience the backcountry.
And we get to hear this presentation tonight at 6:30.
Yes.
And then it'll repeat again at 8 o'clock. These are both at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center.
Yes.
The elevators will be operational,
yes.
So people don't want to walk all the way up the stairs. They can just come around the corner and go into those elevators.
Exactly. Do watch your step. There's some ice out there.
Yeah, there always is at this time of year, so it might be a good idea to just stick the cleats in the car and make sure
it's a good idea
that you want to slip those on when you walk that sidewalk. I've seen people fall out there, and it's not pretty. Okay, but the talk is worth the walk, folks, absolutely. John, thank you so much for being willing to share and telling us the story. Welcome, Chad. I imagine you'll be in the audience and appreciating. Are you going to say a few words as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to John's presentation, and I think, I appreciate being on today.
Okay,
thanks,
it's 3:30, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, January the 9th, 2015. It's the birthday of Richard Milhouse Nixon, born Yorba Linda, California, 1913. Grew up poor, Quaker family, in the town of Whittier. Family ran a grocery store, gas station. He won a scholarship to Harvard, but his parents needed his help in the store, so he stayed home, went to a local college instead. Went to Duke University, then became an attorney in Whittier. He auditioned for a community theater production and met a high school stenography teacher named Pat Ryan. He was in love with her. She was not sure. Nixon wrote to her in a letter, "Every day and every night I want to see you and be with you, yet I have no feeling of selfish ownership or jealousy. Let's go for a long ride Sunday. Let's go to the mountains weekends. Let's read books in front of fires. Most of all, let's really grow together and find the happiness we know is ours." He'd served in the Navy during World War II. He learned to play poker, which was not tolerated in his Quaker family, but by the end of the war he'd made almost $10,000, and he used that money to fund his first political campaign and was elected to Congress with 60% of the vote. It's the birthday of Simone de Beauvoir, born in Paris, 1908, author of The Second Sex. Gloria Steinem said, "If any single human being can be credited with inspiring the women's movement, it is Simone de Beauvoir." It's the birthday of the playwright Brian Friel, born in County Tyrone, Northern Ireland, 1929, author of Philadelphia, Here I Come, Dancing at Lunasa, other plays. It's the birthday of the New York Times fiction critic Michiko Kakutani, born in New Haven, Connecticut, 1955, daughter of a Yale mathematician, known as a fearsome reviewer, recently wrote a scathing review of an Ann Beatty novel, and writers have been scathing in return. Salman Rushdie called Kakutani a weird woman, Susan Sontag said her criticisms are stupid and shallow, and Jonathan Franzen called Cacatani the stupidest person in New York City. Nonetheless, Michiko Cacatani won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism in 1998. Here's a poem for today by Maria Mazziotti Gillen, Everything We Don't Want Them to Know. At 11, my granddaughter looks like my daughter did, that slender body, that thin face, the grace with which she moves. When she visits, she sits with my daughter. They have hot chocolate together and talk. The way my granddaughter moves her hands, the concentration with which she does everything, knocks me back to the time when I sat with my daughter at this table, and we talked, and I watched the grace with which she moved her hands, the delicate way she lifted the heavy hair back behind her ear. My daughter is grown now, married in a fairy tale wedding, divorced, something inside her broken, healing slowly. I look at my granddaughter, and I want to save her as I was not able to save my daughter. Nothing is that simple. All our plans, carefully made, thrown into a cracked pile by the way love betrays us. Everything We Don't Want Them to Know, a poem by Maria Mazziotti Gillen from her collection All That Lies Between Us, published by Guernica Editions, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My next two guests are going to bring us up a very brief announcement here about a wonderful program coming up Sunday. Tom Locker and John as a return guest. It turned out as he was walking out, somebody said, "Hey, he's singing in the show. Let's bring him in and we'll talk to him on this thing." So we did. John Neary's back with us. So this is Juno Cabaret. Happens a few times a year. Tom, you're the accompanist.
Four times a year.
Yeah.
I'm one of the accompanists. Laura Haywood, who's here in the studio with us, is the producer. And thanks for having us on the air again.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. So this coming show is Sunday, the 11th, at the Rockwell Ballroom. That's upstairs at the Old Elks, 109 South Franklin. Begins at 7, and it's pay as you can. Everyone's welcome. We've got a lineup of great singers, over a dozen great singers, and about a half dozen volunteer accompanists. It's a lot of fun. Everybody goes on for two songs, and the whole show runs a little under 2 hours. There's also an intermission there. So we hope to see everybody at 7 o'clock, or they can join us in progress on Sunday night.
I got to say, this is an absolutely cool program because, like so much that happens in Juno, this is local. This is us.
Absolutely.
But it's us with guys like Tom and Laura, people like Laura, who come in and basically take our voices and turn them into something that surprises us and the audience in the end, because it sounds so really good. John, you're going to be singing?
I will be. I have a couple of tunes I'm going to be singing.
And what are they?
You Can't Take That Away From Me, which most people might remember Fred Astaire singing to Ginger Rogers in 1937. And that was the Gershwin Brothers. And the next one is The Very Thought of You, a song written by Ray Noble.
Well. And each performer does two songs.
That's right. Each performer does two songs. We have a great lineup, and this time we have three newcomers to Juno Cabaret, including some of our perennial favorites. Salisa Toll, who was just here, had to leave for another commitment, but she's going to be returning for the third time. And then two of the cast members that were also in the Perseverance production of Chicago are going to sing in Juno Cabaret with us this time, Olivia Shrum and Alex Brown. And then we have another newcomer, Audria Evans, who just moved to Juno recently and asked me at a party recently, hey, is there anywhere to sing jazz or cabaret in this town? And I said, well, January 11th.
As a matter of fact,
had an answer. We're signing you up. So she's going to be a newcomer, and she's very good. She's sung before, and it shows. So,
well, this is a great program. This is at 7 o'clock. It's up in upstairs over Rockwell.
That's right.
And it's Juno Cabaret. What's the charge?
It's a pay-as-you-can show, but Rockwell will be open, so we want people to buy food.
Oh, okay.
And the bar service will be brought upstairs,
oh,
so people
nice.
Can have their drinks upstairs.
Uh-huh.
If you're under 21, though, there will be a place you can sit without a 21 and over guardian.
Oh, okay.
And not drink. So, as I said, everyone's welcome. It's pay as you can, and we hope to see everyone there.
Nice setup. Good deal. Okay. Juno Cabaret, it's back. It's Sunday, 7 p.m. at Rockwell. Take it in, folks. It's a hoot watching your friends sing professionally in front of you, listening to them.
Thanks again, Pat.
Yeah.
Generator Theater Company presents A Lifetime to Master by Mary Ellefson, playing January 14th to 25th at McFeeters Hall. Carved from interviews with nearly 60 community members, A Lifetime to Master is an attempt to better understand the complicated issue of homelessness here in Juneau. Tickets for A Lifetime to Master are available online at generatortheater.org, at The Jack, and at Hearthside Books. This message brought to you by Generator Theater Company.
You may have thought you were coming here tonight to sit back and take things easy while we did all the work, but we're going to ask you to help us sing this one. Michael, row the boat ashore.
Hallelujah.
Michael, row the boat ashore.
Hallelujah.
Get the idea. All you do is come in on the hallelujah. Now clear out your throat and try singing that.
Hallelujah.
Oh, I can hardly hear you. Try it again. Don't let your neighbor look at you peculiarly if you sing too loud. You kick him in the ribs and get him singing too. Michael, row the boat ashore.
Hallelujah.
Michael, row the boat ashore.
Speaking of Row the Boat Ashore, tonight's presentation we've just heard about a little bit is going to be John Neary out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center at 6:30, and again at 8 o'clock he's going to be talking about paddling multiple times across the Admiralty Island on the canoe route. My next guests are here to tell us about the program that's coming up at Treadwell Arena. Christy West from Zach Gordon is also here, and Teresa Reynolds, who's also with Zach Gordon, is here. They're going to talk about a program called Toddlers Around Town. I think we're talking about opportunities for folks to take advantage of with their kids. Is that pretty close to the topic, Lauren?
That's right.
Yeah.
So next week we have, through the City and Borough of Juneau and the Parks and Rec Department, we're inviting everyone for Toddlers About Town, and this is free admission for children 7 years of age and younger and their parent or guardian in a couple of our facilities. So you can come and see how much fun playtime can be. And on Monday, from 9:30 to 10:30 at Diamond Park Aquatic Center, you can come and swim for free, and all the play features will be available. And on Tuesday, January 13th from 9:45 to 10:45 will be open swim in the nice warm pool at Augustus Brown. And then Wednesday it will be at Zach Gordon from 11 at noon. And I'm going to turn that over. information.
Hi, I'm Teresa. I'm the Jesuit volunteer at the Zach Gordon. For Wednesday the 14th, we're going to have our rock climbing wall open for any toddlers and their parents that want to come in. It will include introduction to rock climbing and the basics on how to do it, and then also belay instruction for the parents so they can belay their kids. And that way they're able to come back at any time and use the rock climbing wall at the Zach. And we'll also have our racquetball room open as a playroom, and we'll have basketballs and some other balls around for them to play with.
And these programs that we're talking about, is there a cost for coming on these?
Not next week. It's all free. That's from January 12th through January 16th.
So this is a real opportunity to kind of check out the possibilities here.
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm toddlers on a climbing wall. I'm trying to figure out that you must have to be pretty careful about how you introduce that.
Right. So we'll include safety instruction about it and showing the kids how to do it. It does depend on the child. I've seen kids though with no fear at that age. They don't realize like they're
what age?
I would say for good hand-eye coordination and ability to climb. 3 to 7 would probably be the ideal range. And you can see the little kids, they just want to go up it and. They don't mind if they're 20 feet or 10 feet off the ground. They're having a good time.
Okay. It's a different feeling than I have. Raw terror and fear is my take on this. But the kids just love it.
Yes. We have a lot of kids that like to do it.
Okay. When people bring their toddler age kids to the pools, what's the safety situation? Is there a lifeguard or how does that work out?
Yeah, you bet. There's right around the shallow pool, there's lifeguards that are walking around, keeping an eye on things as well as the head lifeguard up in the chairs. So, yeah, it's a safe environment. They do have all the toys that are available for this open toddler time as well. So, as Lauren had said, at Diamond Park, that's available 9:30 to 10:30 on Monday, and then on Tuesday at 9:45 to 10:45, that will be open. And obviously, there aren't the play features there, but you do have that nice, warm waiting pool, again, mm-hmm. with lifeguards available.
Okay, and the waiting pool is large enough that you can get a number of toddlers in
there?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, actually, it's really comfortable for adults because it's nice and warm. It's just a nice place just to float around in.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and then if there is additional days, there's Thursday and Friday available also, Thursday at Treadwell Ice Arena and on Friday at Mount Jumbo. And Mount Jumbo will have just an open gym area. They'll have soccer balls out and some nets, and they have a couple little jump apparatuses that they'll get out, all the different toddler toys. And I'll turn it over to, this is Christy speaking, and I'll turn it over to Lauren to talk about the Treadwell Ice Arena.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. So on Thursday, January 15th, we will have our toddler time from 9:45 to 10:45. And this is something that we were adding to our schedule for the rest of the season. And we also have other toddler times available, but January 15th will be our free time. And we have some great success. We have kids that are a year and a half out on the ice with skates, and we have little push bars for them, and we'll be offering a lesson, and we play. It's all about being comfortable and playing out there. We have bean bags and these little push bars for them to use and help them to have some success on the ice.
The younger people let their kids enter into these activities, then for the rest of their lives, the kids are going to feel comfortable with this kind of thing, this kind of background. I can imagine a toddler learning how to handle himself on a climbing wall and being able to take that into adulthood. And the same thing with ice.
Yeah, life skills.
Yeah, these are very much. So it's a wonderful thing to have the opportunity to try these things out and have your kids try them out and give them the opportunity to take a look at it and find out what wonderful facilities we have available. People say that there's nothing for kids to do in Juneau, and that is so wrong that it's almost a classic mistake to think that that's the case.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing folks out next week.
Okay, one more time, run through the hours for me.
Okay, so it is Monday through Friday. On Monday at Diamond Park Aquatic Center, 9:30 to 10:30. Tuesday, Augustus Brown, 9:45 to 10:45. Wednesday at the Zach Gordon Youth Center Climbing Wall, 11 a.m. to noon. Thursday, Treadwell Ice Arena, 9:45 to 10:45, and Friday at Mount Jumbo Gym, 10:30 to noon. This is a free program to introduce the TOTS to all these different recreational programs we have to offer at Parks and Rec.
All right. Christy, Lauren, Teresa, thank you so much for bringing us up on the event. And folks, take advantage. This is your chance to put your child into some really interesting activities and find out how much fun that can all be.
Governor and Lieutenant Governor with their families cordially invite you to join them for the 2015 Juno Inaugural Ball, an evening of rainforest revelry. Saturday, January 10th at Centennial Hall in the Juno Arts and Culture Center from 8 p.m. until midnight, with an after party at the Jack until 2 a.m., featuring a variety of live music at both venues, dessert tables, and a no-host bar. Tickets available at jahc.org, Hearthside Books in the Jack. Additional details at the Alaska Inaugural Ball 2015 Facebook page.
9 minutes before the hour. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. My next guest is Brian Holst. Brian, you're here to tell us about the 2015 Innovation Summit.
Yes, Pat, thank
you.
This
has happened before, this Innovation Summit.
It has. This is the fourth annual Innovation Summit. We're really excited about how this event has turned into really an opportunity for the community to come together to talk about growing our economy. And when I say community, I mean the region. It's an event where we bring... We had 250 people come last year, about 150 from Juneau, another 50 from around the region, and then a good number from up north and even from down south. And that's a function of what the event is about. It not only talks about those industries important in our region, but it's an opportunity for us to bring in fresh perspectives from outside.
So the focus of the event, Innovation Summit, is to try to come up with ideas, not necessarily to present ideas to people, but to bring them out of the attendees. Is that the sense of it?
The reason we call it Innovation Summit is because it's about economic development and what drives economic development, what drives growth in an advanced economy, and that's innovation. That's the primary driver. So people coming up with new ways to do things. We're not in a situation anymore where we can throw cheap labor at things. We don't want to be throwing our environment at things. We've got to be doing more with less, right? Right.
About $3 billion less, as I understand statewide.
Yeah. So that's the name Innovation Summit. And we have some new elements this year that are going to do a little bit of what you said. We have this, in addition to some really great speakers, which I want to talk about some of these speakers because I think people will want to come and hear these speakers. But we added a piece in here called Innovation Shorts, because people come to this event and they get to collaborate and network and share, and they say, I got something I want to contribute as well. So we've created an opportunity for people to apply to make short presentations. And the format for the short presentations are going to be such that the audience will get to choose which ones they want to see. So we'll have multiple short presentations going on at the same time. And we've had a great response so far to these innovation shorts. And we encourage people to if they've got, if they want to participate in the summit, to present at the summit, you have to actually go to the summit, because the idea is that you can also present your idea, but then you also share the time networking with people. But that's a new dimension that we've added to the summit this year. But the primary focus of the summit is really to focus on those key industries in our region, those the seafood industry, the ocean products industry, as we like to call it, the visitor products industry, mining, the arts and culture, to sort of understand how each of those industries can do better. And we know in economic development that you get the most growth from building on your strengths. Those things that you already have in your economy is where we need to put most of our attention to make sure that those are can be as effective in growing your economy as possible. That's where the new jobs come from. That's where the new firm formation comes from. 95% of job growth and new firm creation comes from those sectors that already exist in your economy. So that's what this is about. But it isn't doing the same old thing. It's innovating. It's reinventing yourself. So that's what this event is about.
I was listening to an NPR story. Actually, it was on the business program that comes on about 5:30 in the evening. Last night, it was a report about Wyoming. That was where the center was. They were talking about the fact that Wyoming had learned from the fact that at one point they only had $80 in the governor's fund, and so they had diversified their economy. And one of the things that they kept saying repeatedly was that most of the states that had been affected by the oil price crunch had diversified their economies, with the exception of, and Alaska came at the top of the list of the ones that have not diversified their economies. So this is really a conversation about diversification.
Well, in the context of Alaska, certainly. We are focusing on those groups that exist in our region. While oil and gas is really important to the state of Alaska, it's not a big employer. Some people would argue that state workers are employed by oil. But I mean, in terms of direct private employment, it's a bunch of other sectors. And yes, our attention is on these other sectors and how to grow them. And it's not us coming up with ideas. It's engaging people in those industries for them to think in new ways about the market opportunities out there and how they can collaborate amongst competitors to come up with better ways to increase their market share in our region, but also to be bring in more dollars from outside.
Collaborate among competitors. That's an interesting phrase. It's one that scares the devil out of most business owners, I think, because most of us, while we make nice in public about our competitors, we're also somewhat frightened of them most of the time, lest they decide to engage in a price war or something like that.
Yeah, and
how do you encourage that kind of collaboration?
And that's great. And the approach that we take, the strategic approach to economic development that we follow is around this cluster work. And cluster is the term of economic term that's used. In order to advance these clusters, it's that collaboration which is the key. And that doesn't come naturally. I mean, it's not, lots of firms talk to each other and things happen. But we know that growth is accelerated when you encourage that collaboration. And sometimes that takes a third party, which is in this case, JEDC and its partners, helping to bring these people together and asking them one question, how can we strengthen our industry? And then they come up with ideas and initiatives that they pursue.
To participate in the 2015 Innovation Summit, what does one have to do?
Well, you go to our website at jedc.org/innovation, or just go to the JEDC.org website and you'll see a button on there. And register. The early bird registration is through next Thursday, the 15th.
Okay, good.
So please register now.
Okay.
This is an event for everyone. If you say, "Oh, I'm not involved," in an industry group, one of the really hallmarks of the event is the new perspectives that we bring in. We have three speakers that we're bringing to Alaska for the first time. Each one. One of the speakers is Armelle Solalac, and she is from France. She works in a French mountain cluster, and we look around us and we look at the tourism opportunity in our community. We see the role that mountains play, and it's an example of this active collaboration from France coming to talk to us. We have other speakers on our website that, of course, we want people to take a look at. We have a professor from MIT talking about innovation and entrepreneurship and the difference between the two and how to build that capacity. And do we have time for one more?
One more.
And Mark Skinner, who's from the Regional Innovation Acceleration Network, and he's going to talk to us about what is it that organizations need to do in order to help grow firms.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Cast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.